Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Darius Coombs, a Mashpee Wampanoag, has been working in tribal education for more than 30 years. The Mashpee Wampanoag people have inhabited present-day Massachusetts and eastern Rhode Island for more than 12,000 years. There were 70 different communities, and they're still here, telling stories about planting, fishing, hunting, slavery, and colonization. Darius Coombs says, for us, Thanksgiving kicked off colonization. Our lives changed dramatically. Darius Coombs is cultural and outreach coordinator for education for the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. The Mashpee Wampanoag Museum is located in Mashpee, Massachusetts on Cape Cod and is open Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Darius. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. How are you doing today?
Good. Thank you. As I was talking to you before the show, I'm sure you get so many media invites to talk about the true history of Thanksgiving. And, you know, we think it's important to do these shows every year, but we also do shows about Native issues throughout the year. So it's not just a one-time thing for us. And I think that's slowly changing in the national media. What are your thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah. Like you said, Rose, I've been doing this for about 30, 35 years in education. I've done numerous presentations and interviews. And things are changing. You know, it always can get better. We always strive for more and more. You know, we do want people to think of us more on a 12-month schedule than just 1 month out of the year. So I'm glad what you're saying. This is not just a one-time shot. We'll go back a few months later down the line and talk about more different subjects. But people these days, you know, there's a book called The Lies My Teacher Told Me. Mm. And people want to know the truth, you know.
Right.
And a lot of our true history is not pretty. Sometimes it hurts the ears. But it needs to be said because this is our history.
Right.
What we went through.
Well, let's talk a little bit about you before we dive into the history. When did you start learning about this history? Was it something your family talked about?
You know, that's been talked about for the last couple of weeks. Like, for us, me being a Mashpee Wampanoag person, right? What a lot of people think, you're a Wampanoag, so you must, no matter who you are, so you must know your cultural history. And people are not born knowing this, what I know. Yeah, I was born knowing I'm Mashpee Wampanoag. Sure, I was born to the customs and traditions, but to actually know the history, what's happened to our people, you have to do your research. Mm. You have to listen to the oral history. You have to look at these written documents, that what they wrote about us, and interpret that. So, I've been doing it for quite a while.
How did you get involved in doing this kind of work and doing this extensive research?
I worked at a museum. Called at one time Plymouth Plantation. It changed over to Plymouth Patuxent Museum. Now the title, it's a living history museum, which portrays the Mayflower coming over in 1620 and the story of the Pilgrims. So you have reenactors up there, and we also have a Wampanoag Indigenous program there. So you got people who played a pilgrim in character, right, and they were portraying 1627. And then you go down to the Wampanoag home site, we would be in present day. We were just portraying ourselves. We would hire real Native people. And I was hired at a young age at 14 to be an interpreter. So I started learning then a lot about the history, then interpreting to the guest. And that museum right there gets about 200 to 300,000 guests a year.
Wow.
It's very popular, yeah. So I've heard it all, I've seen it all, you know.
I bet. I mean, can you share some stories with us? I was struck by this piece in the Washington Post called, and you were quoted in it, "This tribe helped the pilgrims survive for their first Thanksgiving, still regret it 400 years later." And it's by Dana Hedgepeth. And she writes about Plymouth Bay, and how, you know, so many people were looking at the replica of the ship, but few people bother to visit the statue of, is it Osamequin?
Osamequin, meaning yellow feather, known as Massasoit.
Okay.
He's the one that made a treaty with the pilgrims in 1641.
Well, she writes that few people bother to visit his statue, and that that really struck me. So can you tell us some stories about that and what your experience?
Well, we just had the 400th of the Mayflower landing, 2020. We know what happened last year with everybody around the world. Last year was pretty much canceled out. So all those presentations, all those performances were pushed up to 2021 this year. And it's a big, you heard the term celebration and commemoration back today. I know for a fact that people use the word more celebration, although they might use commemoration, but they mean celebration because a lot of these folks benefited off what happened in the past. So when you come to Plymouth, what we call Patuxent, it was always a Wampanoag community. Today, there's visitors that people come from all around the world. And what brings them there is one rock. It's called, known as today, is Plymouth Rock. And literally people fly in to see this one rock. And it's a big monument built above it, and people look at it. I'm not sure what else they expect to see. But it's just a rock. I don't know if they expect to see fireworks coming out of it or what. They travel hundreds, if not thousands of miles to see this. And the town of Plymouth is all pro-pilgrim. It's all focused on the pilgrim story. Mm-hmm. And there's very few physical landscapes of the Wampanoag presence.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Because it's so interesting now that we're having this conversation about names, about statues, about the true history of this country. And you could go to so many major, major landmarks in this country and maybe see a mention of Native people, but it's usually, look how beautiful these baskets are. Look how beautiful this clothing is. It really doesn't even scratch the surface when it comes to the truth. So what was that experience like for you? I mean, especially in the beginning.
The experience in what way?
Well, just the fact that there's so much focus on the pilgrims and not much focus on the Native people who've been here for thousands of years, or for thousands of years.
It's America. That's what people call this country now, America. And that was the first colony that seceded, Plymouth in 1620. You had St. Augustine out of Florida, which failed. You had Jamestown, which failed. But Plymouth seceded. And then making a colony kind of opened up the doors, the floodgates, for the people coming in with different ways of thought. And different ways of thought, where they came in, that's when you saw colonization. That's when you saw it placed on Christianity. That's when you saw laws favoring one side. That's when you saw the thought of land being different. One side believed in ownership of land, and the other side did not. We, as a people, believe we are part of the land. There's no separation there. We're one with it. And that eventually caused conflict along the line in the future, which caused a war. So that's why people come to Plymouth, because it was a colony that seceded. Right. And Mayflower coming over and landing. And yeah, we did help them survive that first winter in a way, and help them secede in their colony, It's weird. It's not weird, but for them, they landed during a perfect time, right? What happened to us prior, about 2 to 3 years prior, there was a major plague that came through here, our area, that wiped out up to 90% of our people within a two-year span. And what we know about the plague is people's skin turned yellow, people got open sores on their bodies, and once they got it, they died within 2 or 3 days. So you look at, I don't know, there was no reason to count heads back then, but we're guessing anyways around 100,000 Wampanoag people, and that plague devastated up to 90% of our people. Wow. This is right before the pilgrims landed. And when they landed, they first landed on Cape Cod, right? And they were thinking about scouting, staying down there, they were scouting out the area. They found Native burials, right? And these burials were turned over. One group of men took from the burials. The other did not, and recovered them. They also found Native church pits full of dried corn, in which they took with them. It wasn't given to them. But there was something called First Encounter that broke out on Cape Cod. It involved the Nauset Wampanoag, the leader being Aspinet down there, the chief, and the colonists, you know. And there was a little fight that broke out. There was musket ball shut off. There was arrows that were shut off. But nobody got killed, fortunately. But the colonists were forced out. That's when they landed in Plymouth, we call Patuxent. And the main reason they're allowed to stay here is because in Patuxent, there was nobody living there. And our way of thought is, we don't believe in ownership of land. If nobody lives there, go and settle there. So, and that's what they did.
So going back to the disease for a minute. So this happened between 1616 and 1619.
Yeah, around those years.
And
there's a lot of guesses on what it was, you know.
Right.
I always told folks it doesn't matter to me what you want to call it. What I do know is the most devastating thing that ever happened to our people, period. We lost spiritual leaders. We lost traditionalists. We lost chiefs. We lost councilmen, kids, elders, parents. To truly understand the traditional and political structure back then, you would have to, in my opinion, go back before plague hit, before disease hit. Some people call it hepatitis. Yellow fever, disease control is calling it leptospirosis. They believe it's from French trade ships farther north, up in Maine. And on those ships, there were rats. And the rats would get off the ships, and the fetus of the rats would get into the drinking water, creating an infectious liver disease that spread down the coast. Mm. And you go from northern Maine, that plague went 30, 40 miles inland. And it wiped out whole nations of people. And for us, it was very devastating for our people. And that plague stops dead in its tracks right around Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island. You think about that. Why would the plague go northern Maine, sweep along the coast, and stop dead in its tracks, right? There's two ways of thought about this I have, right? One, the Narragansett people, which were down there beyond Narragansett Bay, and the Wampanoag did not have that great of relations. So if you don't like each other, you're not going to have that physical contact with each other. So it's hard for disease to spread. That's one reason, right? Possibility. Two, you got Narragansett Bay, which is a large body of water, and it's hard for disease to spread over water. So that plague stopped right there. And unfortunately, we got affected by it the most.
This part of the story doesn't get that much attention, but before the landing, a wave of trade ships from England, the Netherlands, and France arrived on the shores. Based on your research, do you know when first contact actually happened?
Actually, I do. I got a whole presentation on that. You use the word trade ships, right? And before the Pilgrims landed, that's what people were called, traders and fishermen. Yeah. The English, the Dutch, the French. These fishermen and traders came here, right? And my presentation I give out now, if you're going to say that, right, fishermen and traders, you have to add on the term enslavers to it. The fishermen, traders, and enslavers that came from Europe. And this is all true facts. This is nothing we make up. This is what they wrote down and what they did to our people. That was considered to be normal for them back then. To take us, bring us over to Europe, over to England, France, and teach us how to speak the language, at least try to, and try to bring us back as guides and interpreters. On the most part, we never made it back because we didn't have any built-up immunity to what they had, so we died. And the ones who made it back, the very few, were the guides and interpreters. So, and that was going on for like, at least 100 odd years before the Pilgrims arrived here.
Okay, so we're talking 1500s.
Yeah, the first written recording, I think, was in 1524. And that's when Gomes, his name was Gomes, he went down to Narragansett people country and took a whole bunch of Narragansetts as slaves.
Wow. I mean, when you think about it, if you could put yourself back to the 1500s and no contact with anyone else, and all of a sudden these ships arrive and you're taken as a slave for how many days does it take to get to, England from there? And then
I don't know. They left. Mayflower left in September. They landed in November.
Okay, so then you're
planning on landing. They weren't even planning on landing here. They planned on landing down in Jamestown. They got blown up for us.
So you're basically taken from your people, and you have no idea what these people are saying. You're put on a ship for about 2 months, taken to England, and then forced to learn English. I mean, you can't even. I can't even wrap my head around that.
We were exotic specimens over there. We were putting on stores. Slaves, servitude, pranced around as an exotic specimen.
And then can you tell us the stories about, so for example, since we're talking about history beyond this, although I did find an interesting project that you were part of called the Mayflower 400. And this project is really interesting because it's really trying to educate people in England and France and the Netherlands about what happened. And so what can you tell us? Do we know any more stories about indigenous people who were taken to England and just how they were treated and what their experience was like?
Yeah, there's a couple of examples. And we know the ones who made it back. We know, I'm sure a lot of you folks heard of Martha's Vineyard Island off of Cape Cod here. What we call Nope. It means place in the middle, right? We know a chief, his name being Epinal, was taken back in 1611 by an English captain named Harlow. Harlow went down the coast of Maine, Casco, Maine, took native people from there. Went over to Nantucket, took more native people as slaves. By the way, this is 1611, right? Mm-hmm. Went to Nope, Martha's Vineyard, and took Epinal and a few others as slaves. So he took a chief as a slave, right? We know this for a fact. They were brought over to England. They stayed in London. Epinal was a very intelligent man. He was a chief. He knew what the English wanted, what they liked, which was gold. So there's a merchant over there named Fernando Gorges who's funding a lot of these trips over. So he goes up the gorges and said, this is 3 years after, 1614. By this time, he knows how to speak English. He knows what they like. He goes and tells Gorges, you bring me back home. We have a lot of gold on the island where I'm from, and I'll show you where it's at. And Gorges was gullible enough to believe him. This area does not have any gold here. Now, Gorges did not know this. And so he hired a captain named Hobson, which took himself and a couple other native people back home, right? And when they were coming to what is Martha's Vineyard, what we call it, Sinope, Epinal and his other Wampanoag men yelled out something in Wampanoag, which they did not understand, the English. And that's when a lot of his men came to the beach, right? The Wampanoag men, Epinal's men, and shot up the ship with their arrows. And that's when he had a chance to jump over and swim the shore. So that's, you hear about slavery, there's not too many good stories about slavery. But he made it back home by tricking the English. And there's another story. We know everybody's heard of Squanto, right?
Right.
Known as the Squantum today. And with him, right, there's John Smith, who mapped out New England back in 1614. When he left his fishing captain behind named Thomas Hunt. And what Thomas Hunt did is he landed in Patuxent. It was Plymouth that took 19 Patuxent slaves. Squanto was one. Went down on Cape and took 8 Nauset Wampanoags as slaves. And a lot was sold to Spain, the remainder were sold to England. Squanto lived with a merchant named John Slaney until 1619. Mind you, he was taken in 1614. 1619, he was brought back home. You think about those years, right? And if you remember earlier what I mentioned, what happened, that plague that happened between 1616 and 1618, that wiped out 90% of the Wampanoag people. when Squanto was over England, that plague was going on at his home. And when he came back with Thomas Dermer as a guide, he was going down the coast of Maine, seeing this devastation, right? When he came home, he found out mostly all, if not, well, at least most of the Patuxent Wampanoag, which he was wiped out from the plague. For some reason, he was allowed to stay. And when the English landed, the Pilgrims landed in 1620, he went to go live amongst them until he passed away in 1622. By a lot of Native people's eyes, he was considered to be a traitor. But I look at him as a changed person. He was living a normal life until 1614. Taken as a slave, lived over England for 5 years. Brought back in 1619, finding out all those people pretty much had died. And that's going to change any person mentally in the head, you know? I say change because he'd run to Wampanoag leaders and say the Pilgrims are ready to attack. Then run back to the Pilgrims and say the Wampanoags are ready to attack. He tried gaining power on both sides because he had something special. He knew about English culture, and he also knew about Wampanoag culture. And there weren't many people who knew about both. So instead of using it for the good, he used it for the bad.
Right.
He eventually died in 1622, leading the Governor Bradford down on Cape Cod to meet with the Monomoy Wampanoag people, Monomoy being a Wampanoag community, to do some trading. And that evening, they mentioned Squanto having a nosebleed that wouldn't stop. And that was what they called Indian fever back then. But he knew what he did wrong, right? The reason I say this, because the sources say that when Squanto was dying, he was asking to be allowed into English gods.
That is just really an incredible story. Today, we are speaking with Darius Coombs, Cultural and Outreach Coordinator for Education for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. Darius Coombs is Mashpee Wampanoag and comes to the tribe with 35 years of educating people on Wampanoag and Indigenous cultures. The Mashpee Wampanoag people have inhabited present-day Massachusetts and eastern Rhode Island for more than 12,000 years. There were 70 different communities, and they are still here telling stories about what life was like before contact. And then after contact, slavery and colonization. We have just a minute before break, Darius, but you know, we hardly hear these stories around slavery and Indigenous people.
Because when you think of slavery, you think of Africans, right?
Right.
And we were slaves long before that.
Right.
And we were taken over, you know, to Europe and brought back. The first sign of slavery on our homeland here was back in, I think, 1636. 37, so 20 years after, well, 16, 17 years after the Pilgrims had landed, there were other colonies being established, being Mass Bay, which is Boston, 1630, I should say. Then you got Rhode Island being established. And what happened in 1636 down in Connecticut, was also established, is you had the Pequot Massacre down there. Pequot is an indigenous nation in Connecticut. And the English burnt Pequots alive in their fort. And the remaining Pequots, at least a lot of them, were enslaved. What they didn't want to do was enslave the Pequot on their homeland, because they knew if they enslaved them on their homeland, where they were home, they were most likely to escape. So what they did, they traded them for Africans and brought Africans in, and they were least likely to escape. So that was the first sign of slavery going on. And yet Plymouth Colony still there, you know. Plymouth Colony was not directly involved in the Pequot Massacre, but they were indirectly involved, meaning after that massacre was over, they sent troops down to reinforce the English down in Connecticut, what they were doing.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Your Call. This is a pre-taped show, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Darius Coombs, Cultural and Outreach Coordinator for Education for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. Darius Coombs has been working in tribal education for more than 30 years. giving a lot of talks and doing a lot of interviews, especially around this time of year. Darius, what are your thoughts about the changes that we're going through right now, this kind of racial reckoning in this country? Do you feel that enough is being focused? Well, it's never enough, really, but there are changes in terms of trying to get the truth out about the true history of this country and really what happened when settlers arrived, but even before that. Do you feel like over the 30 years you're seeing enough change? I mean, I'm guessing that you've seen a lot in the last five, for sure.
It's back and forth, you know. It's weird. I can, like, back in the 90s, right? That's when all these big Indian movies came out. You had Dance with Wolves. You had Last Mohegans. You had Squanto. And those movies showed a lot of our culture, our ways of doing things. And especially Dance with Wolves, you know, it showed us in a family atmosphere, you know. And you look at the movies before and during the 50s and 60s, and John Wayne didn't do anything positive for indigenous people, period. Those movies that were put out made us look like running around, killing people, and that's all we did. So, yeah, it's good to hear what's going on lately in the last few years, you know. You get the Black Lives Matter. And it's, people want to hear about the true history, no matter what it is. And a lot of reasons why it hasn't been told is, like I said before, it's not pretty, a lot of this history.
Right.
But it needs to be told. What's going around here, I'm sure maybe around your area too, is Indigenous Peoples Weekend, known as formerly as Columbus Day weekend. Mm-hmm. And the reason we don't celebrate Columbus is, if you're a historian, you know what he did. He came over. He got lost, for one thing. Landed down to indigenous cultures down in the Caribbean. He killed people, killed babies, killed women, killed men, raped, gave disease, all for the price of gold, you know. So he was not a good man. And this is nothing, like I said, I'm making up myself. If anybody did a little bit of research, they can find these facts out themselves. Matter of fact, when those three ships were coming over with Columbus and Ninter, Pinta, and Santa Maria, his priest, which I'm killing myself now because I can't recall his name, his own priest kept a diary on what Columbus was doing, a daily log. It's all from his own words. So look that up, folks, and you'll see the true history about himself, Columbus, from his own priest. So that's why
is it Bartolome de las Casas?
I think that's it right there. Yes, yes. Have you seen those writings?
Oh, yes. I mean, I'll never forget reading Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, and he opens with these quotes. And yeah, it's brutal, but so important to expose that.
Yeah, history like that needs to be told, you know. Me being a presenter, an educator of this history, you know, it all depends who I'm talking to and what the maturity of the audience is. Mm. You know, I talk to a lot of kids, you know, elementary level, and they might want to know about Columbus, but certain things you don't, you know, you're not going to say rape, syphilis, and all that, but you can say in so many words, he wasn't a good guy, and they get it, you know. Mm. So you get a lot of folks around this area, your area, who are celebrating Indigenous Peoples Weekend or Indigenous Peoples Day. You know, because we've been around here for thousands of years, you know. We make a little percentage of the population, but we're a strong people. There's still many a nation still living.
And also, when you look at history and who tells the story, that is finally changing, but it's pretty slow. I mean, you know, in the past, you had archaeologists basically telling the story of natives, and then historians who found some of these writings. But it was really about the traders and the explorers. And I mean, I remember going to an event around Custer, and I mean, some of these men who showed up, they were dressing like him. They wanted to know what he ate for lunch. And I mean, it was just a wild experience to see that.
It is wild. It is kind of crazy. But like I said, it's bottom line for any historian, no matter what they're doing their study on, should give out that true history as much as possible. And then we work with a lot of teachers too, and they're like, how do we handle this? How do we talk about this? And I'll tell them the same thing. Tell it honestly and truthfully, you know? Unless and then you got teachers that will say, there's some things that are cultural sensitive. They're not sure what to talk about. And I'll tell them, pick up a phone, send me an email. Like, if there's a red flag that goes off in your head, yeah, that means something. So call us before you do it.
So are you in regular touch with educators about these issues?
Oh, we are. We are. Mashpee Wampanoag is a very strong nation of people. And around this area, there's 7 districts we serve, school districts that serve our tribal kids. So it's our responsibility as an education team here in Mashpee to go in these schools and do professional development with these teachers and teach them what they need to know about our native tribal kids, what to do and what not to do. But we just got done with some major presentations in the last 2 weeks, which I gave a lot of the history part, but we also did some song and dance, but it was some tremendous presentations. And we're always open for the teachers. We're developing a speakers bureau now. We have indigenous speakers and non-native speakers talking about all sorts of subjects that relate to our people. Mm. It could be cultural, it could be government, what's going on today. So we're going through a lot,
Wow.
I can share another story with you right now. It's kind of interesting, right? For our people, the Mashpee Wampanoag, we got about 300 acres of land in trust. That's nothing, right? Mm. And a few years back, when there was a different administration and government in the United States, that administration took our land out of trust for no given reason. No good reason, right? Just took it out of trust from the Department of Interior. That was all about the dollar, all about financial reasons for this administration to do that. And so we fought back, what they are saying is by 1934, if you weren't considered to be under federal jurisdiction, you weren't considered to be a tribe of people, right? And we said we were. We weren't actually under federal jurisdiction. They said, nope, you want. So we brought the Department of Interior to court. And I heard this case last year on the radio, and the judge is really good. And we had some really good lawyers. And we coached the judge and Department of Interior of different things that happened to our people. One big thing, which is a hot subject now, is boarding schools, right?
Right.
There's a boarding school in Pennsylvania called the Carlisle School. It was one of the first boarding schools after the Indian Wars, right? It was established in the 1880s, and I think it went through the 1920s. And the guy who headed that boarding school up to Carlisle School in Pennsylvania, what his famous quote slogan was, save the man and kill the Indian. Mm. And literally now we know kill the Indian meant kill the Indian, because we're finding all these boarding schools with the mass burials of kids, which is awful to see and hear. But what they also did was wash our culture away. We had to cut our hair. We couldn't speak our language. We had to dress a certain way. We had to assimilate into society. Then we were brought back to our community, if we made it back, which a lot of we know we didn't. And like I said, this school happened. We know the Mashpee Wampanoag people, the kids were brought to these schools, taken away from the homes and brought there. And like I said, the school was 1880s through 1620s, 1920s, right? And guess what? It was under federal jurisdiction. It's a federal school. It was a federal boarding school. So I remember hearing this trial, right? And the judge asked the Department of Interior's lawyer, have you heard of the Carlisle School? And she said, yeah. And do you know that the Mashpee Wampanoag children were taken from their homes and brought to that school? She would not answer the question. She knew if she answered the question there, the case would have been, it was a wrap, it was done. Hmm. So the judge asked her again, do you know the Mashpee Wampanoag children were taken from their homes and brought to the Carlisle School? Once again, would not answer, went around the question. And the judge finally said, I know what you're doing. I know exactly what you're doing. matter of fact, I'm going to close this case out and I'll make a decision in a week or two. Any favor to our for our people, of course, you know, because we he knew the Carlisle School was under federal jurisdiction. And our land got put back in trust. So,
wow. Incredible story. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about were all of these Christianity towns that were popping up all over. I listened to a few of your talks and, you know, you said that the settlers, that the religious settlers either did not understand your spiritual ways or didn't want to. And if you didn't take on Christianity, you were killed. So Christian Town was established in 1659. And then a number of other towns started popping up after that one.
Yeah, that wasn't the first one. Christian Town was over Martha's Vineyard. Yeah, it all starts even back going beyond before then. It starts Manifest Destiny back in the 1450s. There was the Pope over Europe basically said, if the people are Christian, you can do whatever you want to them. And that was all around the world pretty much. And so when they came here, we weren't Christian. We had our own ways of doing things, our own ceremonies. So, like I said, you heard my talk, so you heard me say that, yeah, either they didn't want to understand us, and that's when they placed on Christianity. It's the first part of colonization right there. But we were very, very, and you saw Native people, you saw Wampanoag people taking on Christianity. Some did, some did not. But you had to put yourself in there, as I said, their moccasins back then. You had to walk a mile in their shoes, what they were going through. We just suffered from a major plague. We lost a lot of medicine people. We still had our ceremonies, but we had no idea why this happened to our people. We had never, ever seen such devastation to a culture in our lives. So a lot of folks are probably thinking, like, well, is this something that from our creator, something we've done in the past? So I'm never going to say good, bad. I'll never talk about a person's faith because that's what they believe in. That's their faith. I'm not going to say it was good or bad to take this Christianity on because we're a very changed person, confused at the time. There was chaos going on. And there was one incident, right? Actually, a relative of mine back in the 1640s, he was from Chappaquiddick, which is a community over Martha's Vineyard, a Wampanoag community. His name being Hyacombs. Hyacombs knew the King James Bible so well that he was preaching it to English people, their religion. And not everybody liked this, though, you know. Hyacombs was brought by two preachers, English preachers, to Chappaquiddick, back to Chappaquiddick, because he was in Agatown. He was going back and forth. And they came across a Chappaquiddick chief who was a traditionalist, who did not like what Hyacombs was doing. He basically said, what are you doing? You know we have our own ways of doing things. You know we have our own ceremonies. And literally punched him in the face. And so it's like it was a different time. The 1640s, that's when you've seen a lot of place on Christianity. The first praying town that popped up was 1651, Natick, being John Eliot's community. John Eliot was the one hanging around that area preaching to Wampanoag people about his religion. But you got the John Eliot, you got the Thomas Mayhews of the Vineyard, you got the Richard Bourne's down here in Mashpee, the Cottonwoods. And these praying towns were popping up. So it started out in 1651. It was all going throughout the 1670s, you know. And I just talked to actually Martha's being last weekend, and I was talking to an elder historian, right? And she was telling me that even during the 1880s, Christian Town was still going on. Because she remembers hearing stories of tribal kids in Aquinnah being in a Wampanoag community, visiting Christian Town, and visiting the native kids down there back and forth. So that was still kind of established, you know. But yeah, that's one of the first things that was placed. And think about these praying towns, right? They were kind of caught in the middle. They weren't traditionalists anymore, but they weren't English. They did take on Christianity, sure, but they still weren't English in the blood. So when you had the first major war that broke out between the two people, being the King Philip IV in 1675, guess what? The English said, You're a good Indian. You're a praying Indian, but you're not English. So I can't really trust you. So what they did, they scooped up a lot of these praying Indians and put them on islands off of Massachusetts and left them to die. Deer Island being one off of Boston, Clark's Island being another out in Plymouth. They were sent there with no provisions, no shelter, no food to die because they didn't trust them. So for us as indigenous people around here, around the Northeast, actually happens on Indigenous People's Weekend. We make sacred paddles through these islands and give thanks for these people, these our ancestors, for paving the way so we can be here today.
Today, we're joined by Darius Coombs, Cultural and Outreach Coordinator for Education for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. Darius has been working in tribal education for more than 30 years. The Mashpee Wampanoag people have inhabited present-day Massachusetts and eastern Rhode Island for more than 12,000 years, and they're still here telling their stories. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your calls, but Darius is very busy giving talks all day, so we had to do this interview early in the morning. Darius, sticking with the 1500s and the 1600s, are there some things, I'm sure there are a lot of things you don't know, but what are some of the most pressing questions you still to this day would like to answer about those years?
It's hands down, there's no question about it. It's pre-plague. Mm. You know, I said earlier in the interview that to fully understand the political, traditional climate of our people around here, you have to go before disease hit, in my opinion, you know?
Right,
because like it was chaos afterwards. It was scrambling. It was like, what's going on? And before interruption happened, and like I usually a lot of time I start my talks about was like, this was normal. And I want to give people a base on how we the best way I can, and show what normal was for a 13-moon cycle which we go through, and how we lived before interruption. I've done quite a lot of research, but still today, I don't know everything. Nobody knows everything. There's a lot of guesswork out there. It's basically a big puzzle, right? We got all these pieces and we try to fit them together the best we can. Mm. And it's close, but it's to fully understand it. I'll give you an example, right? I have this discussion amongst my own people too. Usamequin, Massasoit, how much power did he have? We know there was close to 70 Wampanoag communities. We know the names of the communities. I know the names of the chiefs of these communities during that time. I've done a study on that. And what a lot of people think is Massasoit was a great Wampanoag chief of all the people, both Native and non-Native. Something that's what people's way of thought. And I argue that point a lot of the time. Like, how can you say that, really? I can understand how people can say that is because he's written about quite a bit. That's who Plymouth Colony dealt with quite a bit. That's all who they dealt with. They dealt with Massasoit, the Wampanoag community of one community of Poconoke, as far as we know, well, now it's 40 miles away from Plymouth, which is very large, even at the plague hit. Probably the largest one we have had at the time by 1621. He probably had a lot of influence on smaller communities. But did he oversee everybody? I get that point quite a bit. I don't see it myself. Because I know there was Wampanoag leaders that were verbal for him making that treaty with the English. See, there's no universal thought that when the Pilgrims landed, and not everybody liked what Massasoit was doing, making that treaty with the English, how you really felt toward the Pilgrims being here is how you were treated prior before the Pilgrims got here by the European fishermen, traders, and slavers. If your brother got taken as a slave, which happened quite a bit, you're not going to be open arms for another people coming in. There's one Wampanoag leader we know for a fact. His name was Combatant. He was a leader of the Wampanoag community in Mattapoisett. He did not like what Massasoit was doing at all. There's actually something called the Combatant of Fear, which... Combatant took Squanto, being the English's voice, and put a knife to his throat. And there was a Narragansett chief who took Massasoit as hostage for a while. So yeah, not everybody liked what he was doing. But he's famous because Massasoit's written about quite a bit by the English. That's who they dealt with.
You know, thinking about what happened pre-contact, have you read the book by Charles Mann, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus?
I've scanned through it. I haven't read the whole thing quite yet.
What do you think of it?
I think it's pretty good. It's not too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like it.
It's actually pretty fascinating to think about just the societies that really flourished. And I mean, this is another piece that, well, like you said, we don't have the answers, but we just don't really talk about it. Do you spend much time thinking, what if contact hadn't been made, you know, for another couple hundred years? Or what if the people on the Mayflower, because according to Mayflower 400, let's see here, there were 102 passengers on the Mayflower. A lot of these people were servants. I mean, when you look at John Carver, a pilgrim separatist, John Carver had 5 servants with him. And according to Mayflower 400, about half of the people on the board were seeking a new life and not driven by religion. Do you ever wonder, grandma was Pomo from California, and gosh, the history of California is so brutal. I mean, unfortunately, we did have gold here. But I just wonder, like, what if the contact hadn't happened for another couple hundred years? Or what if these people were not sadists? I don't know. Is that a silly question? Is it something you think about?
You know, yeah, I don't think it that far out. Imagine if they tried to land 5 years before. Think about that. Before disease hit. Hmm. Imagine the flourishing nations we would have seen. I can tell you, honestly, they would not have landed anywhere around here. Anywhere along the coastline, north and south. Because it was a very populated area. And we were strong. We were very strong. There were strong nations all around. You know, think about when they landed here, right? They had their ways of thinking, you know. The reason Plymouth is so popular today, because like I said before, it was our first established European colony. And that being successful, that opened up, like I said, the floodgates. So for other people coming in, and different ways of thought. You got Mass Bay in Boston like 10 years afterwards. And there were so many people who flooded, thousands and thousands of people who flooded the Mass Bay. And I look at these records, right? I did a study on Plymouth Colony records. And I did a study on Mass Bay records, that court records that affected Native people. And literally, you can read these records. They're all digitalized, by the way. Hmm. You get these digitalized format, and you punch in the term Indian, and all these laws are highlighted. And you can seriously see from the 1630s, decade by decade by decade, the decline between the relations between the two people. And as I said, 1660s were awful, leading up to war, what we had to face with the laws, the place on Christianity, the thought of land. There's so much favored one side, it was unbelievable.
Right.
And but that's why war broke out eventually, you know? Mm. So the question was, do I think a couple of years, 100 years later, what would have happened? I'm not sure. I never really gave that a full way of thought, but I always think about pre-plague, 5 years before. Hmm. That's more
realistic, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then speaking of laws, I mean, these are just so important. You talk about the 1742 Massachusetts Indian Law. If you're a, quote, remnant of a tribe in Massachusetts, yeah, you have to move. And so, as you say, your people had no choice but to disperse.
No, yeah, that was... Yeah, we, as after the war, the King Philip's War in 1676, that it was over around here, not farther north. You go to New Hampshire, Maine. That was still going on for a couple more years, the war. But the losers of any war, they're not treated fairly afterwards, you know.
Right.
So, yeah, you had scalping that was legal. You had slavery that was legal. You had servitude that was legal. And yeah, remnants is all about the land, you know, and that's what the 1742 law stated was. If you're a remnant of a tribe living in Massachusetts, you have to move to one of four locations.
gonna move to Mashpee, or you're gonna move to Aquinnah or Heron Pond, Wampanoag community on Cape Cod Canal community, or you have to move to Grafton, which is central Massachusetts. And that was all about
taking of the land, you know? Like Mashpee itself got, it's called, they use the term incorporated in 1870. What that means to me is it's taken. And the reason I say taken is because it was considered to be a township at that time. And guess what? If you're Mashpee Wampanoag, you're going to be given so many acres of land back. But guess what? Now it's a township. And us being a town now, you have to pay taxes on your land. And for us, on the whole, we've never been a wealthy people. And that's why how a lot of people lost their land. Some people maintain, still hold on to it today, but not as much as we want, you know?
Darius Coombs is Cultural and Outreach Coordinator for Education for the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe. Darius has been working in tribal education for more than 30 years. The Mashpee Wampanoag have inhabited present-day Massachusetts and eastern Rhode Island for more than 12,000 years. They are still here telling their stories. Darius, thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for your great work.
You're welcome, Rose. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering the show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.